Hi, my name is Cindy Felixson, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Cindy.
Been looking forward to this all day. Part I'm looking forward to is the standing ovation at the end, though. Now, Clancy yelled at Esther a couple of weeks ago for standing up when everybody else stood up for her. But I want to have to stand up because you guys don't stop clapping. And I want to go, no, no. And you guys just keep going. You know, that's what I want. And reminds me one time, I shared this before once or twice, but I saw this Michael Jackson concert on television. I think he was in Hungary or something. You know, this is before, you know. But, you know, he was supposed to appear on stage, and they knew that he was supposed to arrive soon, and the crowd was going crazy. I mean, they were jumping up and down, and they were screaming, and all of a sudden, a bunch of fog goes across the stage. And then they're going even more crazy. I mean, they're going wild. And after a while, he just popped up, and everybody lost it. I mean, they just started crying. And he just stood there for like 2 minutes like this. And then he made, you know, they played like two notes and then he went to the other side. And people were passing out. And that's what I want. Every time I walk in the room. But I don't want to have to do anything for it, you know? Someone asked my son a few years ago, you know, if you could have anything in the whole world, what would it be? And he said, oh, I'd want world peace. He's so much like me. You know, because we want the same things, but I have certain ideas on how you can get world peace. You know, like if everybody drove 5 miles an hour faster tomorrow. If you people who turn right don't slow down so far back before you turn right. That would help world peace, you know. Well, I'm Eskimo. The other half is German and Irish. I grew up in San Bernardino. One clapping. You've never been there, huh? There weren't a lot of Eskimos in San Bernardino. And there are none now. But I just hated it, you know. It was so smoggy, it was so awful. And I remember my dad used to take us on vacation to beautiful places, and we'd come back home, and it was just so gray. I mean, everything was gray, and everybody was ugly, you know. And I just think, God, we could live anywhere on the planet, and we live here, you know. And it's just, it's hideous. My father is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I grew up with his drinking. He's a periodic alcoholic, and for those of you who are new, those are alcoholics who drink for a period of time and they stay sober for a period of time. That's a different kind of alcoholic than I am. And but I remember him drinking Gallo red wine and Brew 102, and and he was a probation officer. And he was handling drunk driving cases. And one afternoon, he decided he should go check out a meeting because he was sending all of his clients here, and he's been sober ever since. So that's, I think, about 24 years, almost 25 years. But I grew up there. I was just awful. You know, I got teased a lot because my eyes were slanted, and I hated the way I looked. I couldn't stand it, you know, and I've shared it before, but I remember I used to come home, sit on the edge of my bed, and I'd like stretch my eyes out so they'd become round, and it worked. But I started smoking dope and they shrunk right back up again. By the end of the party, everybody looked like me, you know? Chuck C. used to say this line, and I just really identified with it. He said, you know, I could not integrate myself into society. And that's the way I felt. I mean, I just could not make myself fit. And the self-obsession was so intense. I mean, I was just aware of how I felt all the time. And I started drinking at a very young age. I've been sober since March 10th of 1977. So I've been sober, thanks, Frank, class of 77. Refer to ourselves as the silent serving class of 77. Where was I? You made me lose track. Oh, forget it. I'll just start over. Oh, started drinking at an early age, yes. And I got sober young, sober 22 years. I'm as old now as I remember Vince being when I got to AA. I remember he was one of the grown-ups here, and that's how old I am now. It just amazes me. I still think of myself as like 19 years old with 22 years of sobriety, you know? And so my father went to AA. That was about the time my drinking really just took off. There were no homeless back in the 70s because my father took them all in. And it was just hideous. We had so many newcomers, you know, with couch commitments way before they were even popular. And I'm not a real active drunk. On a big night, I like to sit up. And if I'm feeling really wild, smoke a couple packs of cigarettes, you know? And Hank says it. I love Hank Johnson. He says, I became an emotional goober. That's what I'm like when I'm drinking, because, you know, and I was in this gang for a while, too, and they're not anything like they are now. But, you know, I was part of the Seven Leafers. I'm sure you've heard of us. And but they kicked me out of the gang because I'm more gang-like when I get sober than I am when I'm drunk. But they just couldn't keep me sober. You know, when I'm drinking and I got the right amount of Southern comfort in me, I love you. I want to throw my arms around you. I want to talk about the meaning of the universe. I want to tell you how much you mean to me and just sob. I mean, that's what I like to do. And I just kind of put a damper on the gang image, you know. So they asked me to not come around anymore. And so my father had all these new people moving in and out. And I went through different phases of drinking. But I started seeing things that weren't really there. And it was really kind of dangerous because my older brother would punch me in the face so that I could see clearly. And I remember one night, my father's sponsor had brought over a gunny sack full of dead, plucked ducks. And my father filled the bathtub up with cold water and threw the ducks in there. And I didn't do a lot of drugs. I smoked a little bit of marijuana but loved to drink. And I remember I was in the bathroom. I threw up almost every single time I drank. I just don't tolerate alcohol well. But I remember one time I was in the bathroom and something caught the corner of my eye. And it kind of looked like they were ducks. But they were really relaxed, you know? And I walked out of there. There was my older brother, and he didn't say a word. So I didn't say anything, you know? I had little glimpses that there was something wrong with my drinking. And I guess I really thought there was something more wrong with my life than really my drinking. And I went to a number of different churches and group therapy and individual therapy. And my emotions were just so intense. I was just so crazy all the time. And you know, my father one night sat me down. I'd been drinking for just a few years by this time, and I'd been drunk for a few days straight, and he said, "I'm taking David to an AA meeting." And David was this young man that I'd met in Alateen. And so I asked him, "Why are you doing that?" He said, "David's an alcoholic." And I said, "Oh God, I'm sorry." And he said, "We're gonna go hear a man named Chuck C talk, and we'd like it if you could join us. Chuck hasn't had a drink in about 29 or 30 years. I remember thinking, why would you want to go listen to someone who hasn't had a drink in 29 or 30 years? I mean, it did not sound like something fun to do, you know? And off they went. In fact, I think it was Byron and Marion's meeting on a Friday night that Chuck was speaking at that night in January of 77. And my father, oh God, there's two glasses of water, excuse me. My father had his first job in sobriety. He was working at Kellogg Mental Institution, graveyard shift running the adolescent unit. And it was wonderful because he was gone every night. You know, he went to a meeting every night, then he went to work, and he'd come home about 8:30, 9 o'clock the next morning. So we had a party at our house every night. And he was working with crazy kids all night, and he'd come home and find crazy kids passed out all over the place. And but you know, this night he invited me to the meeting. He didn't have to work, and he was taking David. David was a few days sober, and off they went. My dad came home, and I'd had some Southern Comfort that night, and I had a couple girlfriends come over that I hadn't seen in a while. I was the kind of kid you weren't allowed to hang out with, and these girls came over. They brought a fifth of Southern Comfort, and I went into a blackout that lasted me 3 days. I came in and out of that. Maybe I was out of it for a total of 20 minutes in that 3 days. And my father came home from that meeting. By that time, I was already naked and had thrown up everywhere. And my brother had punched me in the face because I wasn't seeing things right. And so he wanted to come in and give me a kiss goodnight. I guess he'd been reading The Family afterward or something. And they threw this teenage barricade in front of the door and said, you know, don't go in there. She's got a headache. And finally he went in there and saw me, and I was lying there completely white. My eyeballs were rolling in the back of my head. I'd had spaghetti for dinner that night. Hadn't eaten for a while. And, you know, he just carried me out into the living room and asked everybody what's wrong with her, and they said, well, she's got a headache. And so he threw me in the back of the car, took me over to Riverside Community Hospital into the emergency room. And they started to pump my stomach, and I did it for myself, all over my father and the doctor. And I sat up, I said, oh, F, I'm drunk again, and passed back out. They thought I'd taken a bunch of pills, but I wasn't into pills. I mean, they're like really dangerous. And so I just stayed away from him. Well, I took whites for about 2 weeks once. You know, this guy was given to me for free until you're addicted. And then he says, well, you got to start paying for him, you know. That's how he got his clientele. And, but you know, when you feel like mowing the lawn at 2 o'clock in the morning with flashlight and scissors, you know. Trust me, I don't need to be wired like that. But anyway, they thought I'd taken a bunch of pills, and I just had been drunk for too many days straight, and my body quit working, and I looked like I had been terribly beaten up that night because I had gone on a walk. And the doctor looked at my father and said, Mr. Steckdub, I'm sorry, but we're going to put a 72-hour hold on your daughter. She's obviously trying to kill herself, and she's not far away from doing that. And then we're going to send her over to Kellogg Mental Institution. They've got a great adolescent unit over there. My father said, I know, I run it, and asked if he could bring me home. And Marilyn was gracious enough to give me her weird watch. I have the winning lotto numbers. Do you want them? It's on the watch. I'm not making that up. I remember I was 3 days sober. I came out of the blackout for the last time, and they were shoving me in the back of this car, and they're taking me from Riverside to Pomona to the Triangle Club for my first meeting. I sat in the back of that meeting, and I was still shaking and sweating and throwing up, and I don't remember anything that was said that night. The only thing that I remember was after the meeting, a lady named Martha came up and she started talking to me, and she had blonde hair and she had makeup on her face and she had a real nice soft voice and she was just kind to me, and I hadn't heard kind words in a long time. And that was my first meeting, and I had no idea that I would stick around Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, for this long. I did not want to be sober and I did not want to be drunk. Like I was saying, I had little glimpses earlier that there was something wrong with my drinking, but they're just little flashes from time to time. And I changed my sobriety date because, you know, I found out not only are you not allowed to drink here, but they don't want you to use drugs either. And I was smoking pot before the meetings and at the breaks. And so I changed the date. That's the date I have now. And I think, you know, God's grace is so powerful that I really was in a surrendered state probably for my first 6 or 9 months in sobriety. And somewhere around 9 months or a year, my ego woke up and didn't give me peace for a lot of years. I had 9 sponsors my first 2 years. Kind of reluctant to change and didn't take direction very well. And shared this on Monday night, but I remember sponsor number, I think it was 9, was in this group, and she said, you know, you really should get up and shake hands, and you got to go help those new people. And I just sat there like this, and she said, you know, if they don't, they'll die. And I said, can you think of another reason? You know, she said, well, you'll die if you don't do it. Well, we're getting warmer. You know, and she said, well, you can either go out and drink and continue to live then. And I said, all right. So I mean, got up and started shaking the hands and doing all of the things that we did here, and you know, went to all the moves and the showers and the watches, and you know, went to 10 to 14 meetings a week my first couple of years. And by the time I was 2 years sober, you know, I'd moved around like every 3 months. And I remember lived in Simi, and Frank and I used to drive in. He had an afro and a goatee and an earring then. And, oh man, we were just nuts, you know. And I got this lady named Pat to sponsor me, and she sponsored me. And I didn't think it would work. I mean, I just said yes to her, knowing in a few months I'd be gone. And for some reason, it just worked. And she moved away to Orange County, and I asked Clancy to sponsor me, and I guess I was about 4 years sober then, and he made me take a fifth step with him before my fifth birthday. And I remember doing that because when I grew up, I was molested by my next door neighbor and my babysitter's husband. And I don't remember a lot of what happened, and specifics don't really matter. But the only thing that I did remember was that it was some kind of cold environment. And I remember that when I got really cold physically, I would just break out with welts all over my body. And I remember reading this to Clancy in the car, and I don't know if you've ever ridden in the car with Clancy, but I think they put those blue dots on the freeway for him. And I remember sitting there with my flashlight, and it was pouring down rain, and you know, he was smoking like a chimney. And I got to this part about, you know, how I react to the cold, and I even remember going to the yard and just wearing sweats and just having big welts on my body. And when I got to that part, I remember he threw a cigarette out the window. He rolled it up and turned the heater on full blast. And it was just a weird little thing. But, you know, he was there. And, you know, I haven't any kind of reaction to that at all, you know. And I think, you know, that's the beauty of the steps is that we get freed from those things. This one minister wrote that the past does not exist except held by the thoughts in my own mind. And that the steps free us from that. We get freed from the past. You know, I'm not some harmed individual. It happened, and that's not who I am anymore. And I got to share that with my sponsor. And, you know, the steps allow us to get free of all the stuff. You know, people talk about issues these days. And my only issue was sobriety. You know, I couldn't take it. And it drove me to drink. I just couldn't stand it. And when I was a couple of years sober, I started glancing at some guy from across the room. And, well, when his girlfriend was in Hawaii, I made my move. And she was an Al-Anon. I figured she could just release him. And just help wherever I can. Clancy used to tell me that I was addicted to excitement. But, you know, I love the feeling of falling in love. I just love it, you know. You get to work the 12 golden steps. Life is beautiful. Sobriety is beautiful. It's always been beautiful. Get to the meeting and glance at him from across the room. But if you're like me, that feeling subsides. So I get a sign from God that says, break up with him. And I do God's will. So you break up. And if someone's sitting next to you who's in a broken relationship and they're pretending like they don't like it, there's nothing better. It's great. I mean, your heart rips. Your gut churns. You can listen to sad songs on the way to the meeting. Get there, glance at him from across the room. Show him what he can't have. You never look better than when you're broken up. And but the problem is the pain starts to subside. And so then I get another sign from God that says, get back together. And so we did that for about 5 years. And we just wanted to keep the group busy, you know. Then he went out and got loaded. You know, unfortunately for me, I had a couple things stronger than my obsession for him, and that was a relationship with my sponsor at that point and a commitment to Pacific Group. And he stayed gone for a year, I guess, and he came back, and we started glancing at each other from across the room, and I got pregnant. And so we went to dinner with Clancy, and he said, okay, you're getting married next Wednesday. And it was a Thursday, and I can't remember the name, Aztec, I think is the name of it, some little Mexican restaurant in Lincoln, and I was too sick to go look for a wedding dress, so we got married in 13 days. We were engaged for 13 days, and I had always hated children, and I'd hear them cry in restaurants, and I'd think, God, why don't they just smack that thing? So I was real nervous as to what kind of mother I would become, and so was everyone who knew me. And I remember on September 23rd, I went into labor, and that was a Tuesday night, and I called Clancy at some point. He excused me from the Wednesday night meeting that week, and we called the little Lamaze list, which consisted of all the AA people we knew, and how all these AAs running out of the labor room. I'm laying there trying to look good. And I remember when Daniel was born, you know, he was screaming his head off. And my very first thought was, let me hold him so I can make him feel better. And I'd never felt that way about anything in my entire life. And I just fell in love with this child. And you know, he's such an incredible gift from the program. He's just an amazing child. And I don't know where he gets it. But you know, we were in Iowa driving around one day, and I think this is after his father died from a drug overdose, but he just said, I owe AA so much. And he says, you know, you're sober, and you know, you're the kind of mother you are because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to be with my dad for as long as I did because of AA. And you know, he just thinks that way. It's you know, when he was like 3 and 4 years old, he was praying for the chlorofluorocarbon level in the ozone layer. And one night he thanked God that he was at the top of the food chain. Said, yeah, it's a good position. I remember one time, he was about 4 and a half years old, I guess, and is writing an inventory, and someone I was working with was writing one as well, so she came over about once or twice a week. And I remember Daniel asked, you know, why does she keep coming over? I said, well, we're writing our inventories. He said, what's that? I said, well, we're writing out all our problems, and we're going to share them with God and another human being so they won't be problems anymore. He goes, oh, good idea. I said, yeah, it's mine. And he knows better now, but so kind of left that alone. And on Wednesdays, you know, his grandparents always come and pick him up, and then he goes over there and stays the night. And this Wednesday, following that little conversation, he called me, and he said, what are you doing, Mom? I said, I'm getting ready for the big meeting. That's what he called this meeting. I said, what are you doing? He says, I'm getting ready to write. I said, what are you writing? He says, I'm going to write my inventory. I said, great, but that's not all you have to do. You'll never hear this from the mouth of an alcoholic. He said, what else? I said, well, first of all, you have to see that you have a problem and that there's nothing you can do about it. And you have to believe that there's some power who will do something about that problem, and then you have to ask them to do that. And then you write out all your problems, and then you get to share them with God and another human being. He goes, oh, that's good. I said, yeah, but that's not all either. I said, then you have to be ready for God to take those away, and then you have to ask him to take them away. He goes, oh, so this is the path to peace. I said, well, it's only part of it. There's more. I said, then you have to make a list of everybody's feelings you hurt because of those problems. And then you have to go find them, and you have to go tell them that you're sorry that you hurt their feelings, but you had these problems. And ask them what you can do to clean it up. And he goes, well, that's good. I said, yeah, but that's not all either. I said, then you have to look every single day for new problems that arise. And as they do, you have to ask God to take care of them right then. He goes, oh, that's good. I said, yeah, that's not all either. I said, then you have to laugh and dance and sing and play with God. He goes, oh, I like that one. I said, yeah, that's a good one. I said, but that's not all either. I said, then you have to go find somebody with that very same problem, and you have to tell them how God solved that problem. And when you do that, that'll keep problems out of your life. So he sat there real quietly for a couple of minutes. And then he says, oh, so what happens is you live in God's life and not yours. And I asked him to sponsor me. But, you know, I believe that that's what happens to us. You know, we live in God's life and not ours. I burned my life out, you know. Now he's turning into a teenager. I don't know if how to read this watch. 9:08. Okay, I got a few more minutes to talk about myself. I'll talk to you. I shared this. My friend Rita gave me a cake, and I remember Pat told me when I was a couple of years sober, you know, I used to not talk to anybody ever. And then once you start talking to a sponsor, then you never shut up, you know. They really don't like that part. And I remember Pat said to me, well, I want you to go get a friend. I said, no thanks. It's too much work. And she said, no, that's a direction. I'm like, oh, God. And I remember my very first friend, Patricia. She's from Chile. I remember we used to sit in the women's stag, and we used to say, oh, these little white girls and their little white problems. And we just hated everybody. And and then, you know, Rita came into my life, and we started being friends. And I'm going to give you the key to friendship. This is how you get friends. You have to tune in to their conversation. Only for a moment, though. You only have to remember one thing from everything they said about themselves. And then the next time you see them, you'd say, oh, how'd that interview go? Or whatever that one thing is. And you start building like conversations that way, and you start to build a friendship. And then when you get to be really good friends, then you can go back to talking about yourself. But you take turns. And you know, Rita, and I have another best friend, Richard, and it's just amazing. You know, I'm absolutely current on them with everything in my life. And I remember one Thursday night, a couple months ago, sharing over at the Brentwood Workshop, and I remember someone asked me a question, and they said, can you talk to us about what commitment has done to your life? And I had never really thought about it before, but I love the way that we do things here, and that we're so committed to things, and it doesn't make sense when we're doing them. You know, I was so far from God when I got sober, and the actions, just jumping in here for me was like a meditation, you know. It was just made it a safe place for me to be. And so I told them, I said, it's just amazing that I was so committed to Alcoholics Anonymous and these actions that without realizing it now, that in every area in my life right now, I'm committed to it. I'm just as committed to my son as I am to my education, as I am to AA, as I am to my job, as I am to my family, as I am to my friends. And it's just in every area of my life, you know. And that wouldn't have even sounded appealing when I was new. But what has happened is Alcoholics Anonymous and these tools have made it possible for me to be sober and comfortable at the same time. And I have to be honest, it was a long, slow process for me. Most of the time, you know, I'm pretty content, and I'm pretty good, except for when I'm driving. But if you're new, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, there's the green light. I'm thirsty. I'm really done talking, but I'm going to drink first. If you're new, I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the best possible life, and it has enabled me to live without alcohol and relatively sane for the last 22 years, and I'm glad to be here. Thank you.